Well, listeners, you're listening to the debut of the Morpholica Hair Loss Information Show. I have Dr. Robert Bernstein with us here today. Dr. Bernstein, thank you for taking the time and your busy schedule for this interview.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, I've got a fair number of questions that will be related to aspects of androgenetic alopecia and hair transplantation, but I will also ask you some questions regarding to other types of hair loss like alopecia areata and the secretitricial alopecias. Most of our listeners are fairly educated to a degree about the different options available to them, so I'll tailor my questions primarily for this type of audience. The first question that I want to address here is the dilemma that many young people face when they're losing their hair and are considering getting hair transplants. They typically don't know the degree to which their hair loss is going to progress. When you're in your 20s and 30s, you want to have a decently low enough hairline and you want to have a crown that looks full. But given that you don't know how far your hair loss is going to go, how would you address this scenario for people in that age range?
Well, I think actually it was kind of a leading question. So I think that you gave part of the answer in the way you asked it. That is the big problem with treating younger people. We don't really know how they're going to progress. And so it's important for people to wait a little bit, usually until they're 23 to 25, before you can really get a sense of how much hair loss they may have. And even at that age, it's sometimes very difficult to tell. That's even considering things such as family history. Another problem with transplant people when they're younger or considering surgery when they're younger is that they often want things that are unrealistic. A person in their 20s is what we call backward-looking. They're looking into when they were a teenager, and they want that, as you suggested, a flat hairline, and they wanted all their old density back. But really, transplants are forward-looking. We need to consider what they're going to be like in 10 or 20 years.
Right.
And a density and a hairline that would be appropriate for someone older is obviously not going to be satisfactory for someone that's younger. So it's really best to wait on surgery. Fortunately, there's some other good treatments, such as medication, and that's what the focus should be on in a younger person.
Okay. That's obviously probably what most young people will initially do. I have a lot of people on my website that are in that situation and that are considering hair transplants. And I guess the hard thing to do is convey to them your point that they really should be forward-looking instead of backwards-looking. Sometimes that hairline that they want to be so low, maybe they have to settle for a somewhat higher one. Follow-up question to that is with regards to the donor area, it's sort of been spread as gospel that hair from this area is completely immune to thinning and hair loss. Is this really the case? I mean, for instance, there are people in their 50s and beyond that, while they still have relatively thick hair in that area, the donor area still appears thinner than hair being than it was when they were younger. I look at my own father, for instance, as an example. His donor area, it's still relatively thick, but he has less hair in that area. So when you're young and you transplant hair from that area, can you expect some of those transplanted hair to fall out?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. The donor area for most people is in fact permanent in the fact that the hair that's transplanted will remain. What happens though is in the course of one's lifetime, that hair will change in quality. So the hair actually thins out over time. It's not miniaturization in the sense that hair that's being lost to genetic hair loss is miniaturized. But there's a change that we call senile alopecia, where the hair changes in diameter. It's kind of a uniform change. And so over the time, the donor area and vis-a-vis the transplanted area as well will appear thinner. That said, it's still important to identify the fact that some patients will really lose hair in the donor area. And we call those people DUPAs, or diffuse unpatterned hair loss.
Okay.
And what that means is that the process that's going on top related to androgens is also going on in the back and sides.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to identify those patients, because those patients are not candidates, obviously, for hair transplant, because
correct.
The hair transplanted hair is no better than the back and sides and will fall out over time. DUPA, or diffuse unpatterned hair loss, can be identified by densitometry, and essentially what that is clipping a little bit of hair in the donor area and seeing if there are changes in hair shaft diameter at a young age. And when miniaturized, that finer hair exceeds about 30%, it's very suggestive of this condition. It's also much easier to pick up this condition when someone's a little older, which mm-hmm. is another argument for not transplanting someone when they're too young.
Right. So how long does it take to determine whether someone has that? I mean, when you first take the initial sample, how long do you have to wait before you check again to see if they actually have this? Yeah.
Right. Generally, when someone is experiencing decreased volume, which is usually the first thing that a kid will complain of, mm-hmm. is not that the hairline changes, but, you know, I feel like I have less hair. When I go to the barber, he says I'm thinning, or when I run my fingers or comb through my hair, it seems like it's thinner. At that point, usually we can detect it. We can find increased miniaturization in the donor area. And that can sometimes occur as early as 14 or 15 years old. So
wow.
It really can occur very early. And those patients are usually going to be very bald.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing is that, hair loss is a kind of funny thing. If you have very thin hair all over, it often doesn't look as bad as having dense hair on the back and sides. So even though people with diffuse unpatterned hair loss can lose lots of hair, they actually, because their hair is uniformly thin, actually don't do so badly. And they also can very often respond well to medication for a time that will get them through at least the critical years of their teens and,
right.
and early 20s.
Right. Now, do you recommend that patients continue using treatments like minoxidil and finasteride even after they've had a hair transplant done?
Well, I don't usually encourage people to use minoxidil, and the reason is it's irritating, and it's pretty fussy. People, end up usually after a couple of years stop using, or they only use it once a day where it doesn't really work well.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that minoxidil doesn't offer a lot of benefit to someone that has a transplant. I usually use minoxidil if someone wants to do everything they can to prevent a transplant. So they have early hair loss, they're already on Propecia, and then we use that kind of as an adjuvant. On the other hand, almost everybody that we do hair transplants on, unless they have really extensive hair loss, we suggest to use Propecia.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is twofold. One is that it prevents the extension of the hair loss,
right.
so that hopefully they'll need less surgery. And also, if they have existing hair in and around the area of the transplant, it'll help to hold that. Because
right.
some of that hair can sometimes be lost as a consequence of the procedure.
Right. Now, do you recommend any of the alternatives like dutasteride?
I generally don't.
Excuse me.
The reason why I generally do not recommend it is because we do not have enough information about its long-term safety.
Right.
Merck discontinued the trials with dutasteride. And so they really were not very forthcoming as far as giving us the reasons why.
Right.
So I think that in extenuating circumstances, I think it's appropriate. But in general, we try to use Propecia. And what I'll do over time, if Propecia doesn't seem to be working well, is we'll just increase the dose.
I see. Okay. Now, getting back to transplants, in your own practice, do you perform the so-called mega session transplant? And if so, how many grafts do you use or typically a transplant in one session?
Right. Well, again, it depends upon the patient. Mega sessions are, it's very good to do a transplant in one session or as much as you can in one procedure. However, once you get to very, very high numbers of grafts, there is a point of diminishing returns where you risk having a greater donor scar and you risk poor graft survival.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of mega session was coined by Dr. Rassman about 12 years ago, and it initially started at 1,000 graft procedure.
I see.
in mega sessions were 1,500 graphs, then 2,000, then 2,500. Now people talk of mega sessions as 1,000 graph procedures. And in my view, for most patients, that's way too many grafts to do in one session.
Right.
A procedure around 2,500 grafts is enough to cover most Norwood class 6 patients.
Really?
And you don't have any risk of a wide scar. You don't have risk of what we call central necrosis, where the grafts outstrip the blood supply. Mm-hmm. And also importantly is the grafts are not out of the body that long. Once you get to session 3,000-4,000 grafts, the procedure takes 12-14 hours.
Right.
And we know the graft survival over about 8 hours starts to decrease.
Right.
The survival of grafts outside the body.
Right.
The other thing is that there's often a lot of variability in the surgery. Sometimes patients are more vascular. They pop, or the grafts have a tendency to elevate when you put them in. And all those factors can be dealt with when you're doing large sessions. But when you're doing very, very large sessions and pushing the envelope, if things don't go flawlessly, then you're going to have problems with growth. And you can't always anticipate those problems before you take out that strip.
Right.
So, you know, in my view, what we try to do most importantly is to have a one-to-one correspondence between what we take out of the donor area and what ultimately grows. And so our goal for the first session is always to cover the entire area that you want to cover, try to minimize scarring and maximize growth. And for most patients, we can usually accomplish that in a session of up to about 2,500 grafts, although we will do more if a person has high density, a very large bald area.
Right.
Another thing that's important is that sun damage very often will compromise the blood supply. And so people with long-standing baldness also have chronic sun damage on their head. And that will really limit the amount of graft you can do in one session. So it's really important for the physician to really assess the patient before they do large sessions.
Right. That the sun damage matter was something that I hadn't actually heard before.
It's something it's actually very significant. Most people think that, you know, it's important not to get sunburns or sun after the surgery, and that is important. But the most important thing is the chronic sun damage. And it's not always seen with growth, but you see it's what's called elastotic change, where the sun actually changes the dermis, the connective tissue, and alters the blood vessels.
Right.
And makes the blood supply really much more tenuous than in a healthy scalp.
Right, right. And that could lead to, what was the name of the condition, the necrosis?
Called central scalp necrosis. The blood vessels to the scalp come from the sides. So the more sites you make, the more interference there is with that blood supply.
Right.
And if the scalp is already compromised, you know, from sun damage, then it's possible not to get enough oxygen into the central part of the scalp, and you can get poor growth with that. And it's not always an all or none phenomenon. Sometimes you get suboptimal growth, and
right.
it just doesn't know what it's from.
But that's a fairly rare situation, though, correct?
No, it's not.
It's not.
It's a rare situation to actually get necrosis where the skin dies.
Right.
But it's actually relatively common to get poor growth in the central part of the scalp from when dense packing is done in areas of sun damage.
Okay, well that's a very a good point. I don't think a lot of people are aware of that, and we appreciate that you brought that up,
sure.
And that you take that into consideration when you do a transplant. One would
I think what people don't realize is they get obsessed with these numbers,
right.
And you know 3,000, 4,000. I always like to kid patients that it's like Pinocchio, where the you know the nickel's bigger than the dime.
Right.
You know, more is not always better. And I think that, you know, a hair transplant is serious business. And I think that what you want to do is always minimize scarring and maximize growth.
Right.
And those things are not always accomplished when surgery is pushed to the limits. That said, small procedures that sometimes are done because the doctor doesn't have enough staff or the technique is good is also bad on the other end of the extreme, because then people have multiple procedures, and which again leads to more scarring and inefficient use of the donor area. So really there's an optimal size, and it's different for each patient. We really want to get the surgery done as quickly as possible, but not so aggressively that you risk growth.
Right. And you mentioned that the number 2,500 grafts is typically enough for, or, you know, I guess that's probably a very general statement, but it's typically enough for someone at a Norwood level 6?
A Norwood 6, yes.
That's actually pretty encouraging, because that's obviously very high up on the Richter, or on the Richter scale of hair loss there, the Norwood scale.
Right, and again, that's in one pass. Generally, for a Norwood 6 patient, what we would do is you do about 24, 25 grafts, 100 grafts in the first session, and then you let that grow in, and then a year later, you do a second procedure of maybe 1,800 or 2,000. And that person is now getting 4,400 grafts, and they're pretty well set. I mean,
right.
That's all they generally need. And if you look on our site, you can see, you know, hundreds of patients that have been treated like that look fabulous. And these patients will have very fine donor scars, and they'll also have some grafts in the back pocket in case they lose more hair down the line. So they're not exhausting the donor supply. And I think that patients just often get their donor supply tapped out very early on, and then as they have hair loss down the line, they're going to be stuck.
Right.
I think that the idea is to make someone look as good as possible with the smallest number of grafts, not with the most.
Right, right.
And that really should be the goal of the transplant.
Right. Good point, actually. It, you know, really puts things in perspective. Now let's talk a little bit about the relatively new method of extracting follicles for transplantation called follicular unit extraction, or follicular unit transplantation. Could you please give us a brief description, and then talk about whether you perform it and when you would perform such a surgery?
Sure. Well, Dr. Rassman and I wrote the first paper on it in 2002, although it wasn't our idea. It was first proposed by Dr. Woods in Australia. And basically, the idea is relatively simple. You take a small instrument, and you go around the follicular unit in the back, and you extract it directly from the scalp. The instrument that was used initially was a punch, which is similar to the punches that were used in the old days of hair transplants, but instead of taking out a big chunk of skin with groups of hair in it, you're actually going around the individual follicular unit. And a follicular unit is only about a millimeter in diameter, so you can really make a very, very tiny hole to get these grafts out. So it seems like it would be a great procedure because you eliminate the line scar. The problem with the procedure is that there's a lot of inefficiencies, and they come at a number of different levels. First of all, just to put things into perspective, when you take a donor strip, you're taking out a strip of hair that's in the mid portion of the permanent zone, which is the thickest region of the donor area that is the most stable and has the greatest density. And then you're taking that area and you're sewing it or stapling it end to end, so there's just a fine line. So it's very, very efficient in removing the donor tissue. And then that tissue is placed under a series of microscopes. And under stereomicroscopic control, all the follicular units can be dissected out with any wastage. Okay, so that's in a typical strip, or what we call follicular unit transplantation. With follicular unit extraction, you're going one by one and removing follicular units from the donor area. But because you're removing the follicle and not the surrounding skin, there's only so much of that donor area that you can take out before it starts looking too thin. Because with a strip, you're actually removing the ball tissue as well. So you're limited to how much hair you can take from the mid portion of that permanent zone. So as a result, you start going into other areas to obtain hair. And those areas which are lower down on the neck and higher up on the scalp are not always permanent. Another problem is you're doing the procedure that's essentially in vivo, which means that in contrast to a strip where you're putting things under a microscope outside the body and have complete control over the dissection, when you're doing things directly from the scalp, you really don't have as much visibility as far as the angle of the hair and different things, because you're essentially doing the procedure blind. Because of that, we've modified instrumentation over the years. I just recently published an article where we use a procedure called blunt dissection, where we actually go down around the follicular unit with a sharp instrument, score it, and then use a more blunt instrument to remove the rest of the follicles from the surrounding tissue to decrease the damage. But it's still not as quite as good as using it under a microscope. So although it turned out that, at least we thought that follicular extraction might replace using a strip, it turns out that it's really a supplemental procedure. So it's good for people that really need to keep their hair very, very short on the back and sides. And it's also useful in the rare person that has a problem with a strip incision, where if someone has a line scar that is a cosmetic problem, we can use follicular extraction to take hair from around the scar, from the hair around the scar, and just place it into the scar to make that scar less visible.
Right, that sounds like a good use. What about for people that have a very damaged sort of donor area from poor strip excisions in the past? Is that what you were just talking about in terms of filling in the scar?
Well, actually, that wasn't what I was referring to. What I was referring to is when people have an area that's been harvested that has a visible scar, you can take hair from other areas and put it into the scar and make it go away.
Right.
A line scar. It turns out that when people have very scarred donor area, it's very, very hard to extract follicles out of that scar tissue, and you actually cause wastage with that extraction.
Right.
So it's not quite as useful a tool as we had thought. The other thing for people that have early hair loss that often want to have extraction because, you know, we're limited in the number of grafts, those people eventually, because extraction is a less efficient procedure, may have to go back to a strip incision down the line when they need a lot more hair.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a double-edged sword. It's a nice tweaky procedure, but it's not quite as robust in the sense that it doesn't give us quite the volume of hair as a strip does. And usually the amount of hair is really the constraint in all hair transplantation. It's usually trying to get the most hair is really the goal.
Is there still a lot of room for improvement in extracting follicles using the follicular unit extraction method?
Well, I think there is. And, you know, there are a bunch of us that are working on instrumentation, and every year the procedure gets better. And, you know, I think it needs to be put into the proper context. The other thing is that there's a large patient variability in the ability to extract hairs. So in some people, it's just a very, very easy procedure. There seems to be little or no wastage. In other procedures, the follicles are extremely difficult to get out. So, and I think this patient variability has not been really discussed well. And we really talk about it in every one of our papers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we coined the term the FOX test, for follicular extraction test, to identify the patients that are, not good candidates. And when we first started doing the procedure, it's obviously much, much higher than with the new instrumentation. But even with new instrumentation, the procedure is not good for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Is that just because some people have follicles deeper down in the tissue or closer together? What are some of the factors involved in that?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, at Columbia, we did a series of histological analysis on extracted follicles. And what we thought was that people with coarse hair and thicker scalps, it would be easier to extract. And to some degree, that's true. But it's not universal. And we really don't know exactly what it is in the scalp that makes some people easier to extract, but it's very obvious when you start to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In some people, the follicular units just literally pop out intact, and in some people, the tissue is friable and it kind of falls apart.
Right.
As you try to get them out. The blunt dissection techniques have really helped as far as making more people candidates. But they also have their own problems because with the blunt dissection, sometimes you get buried grafts where the grafts actually fall into the fat and they can't be removed.
Oh.
So it's not a huge problem, but when you're doing lots of grafts, it can be significant.
Okay.
And, so all in all, I think follicular extraction is great. It's still a procedure that's, in an evolution and it's in an early phases, and I think it's certainly very important. Another thing is when there's cloning, there will be, extraction will be beautiful because they don't, we won't need a strip. We just need a little bit of hair, and we can use that. We also use a follicular extraction for small procedures like eyebrow restoration,
right.
Sometimes temple and mustache restoration, where only a limited amount of hair is needed, and we know that there's not going to be a big demand for hair in the
mm-hmm.
future.
So there is a use for it. It's just that for the vast majority of people currently, I guess you're suggesting that if they want to get the most density using the least number of follicles, and probably in terms of cost as well, I guess, strip excision is still probably a better choice.
Yes, yes. It's still the workhorse procedure.
Mm-hmm. What about the final product, the appearance of it? Like, I mean, in terms of any qualitative differences between...
Yeah, I mean, in theory, they should be identical. So in theory, a follicular transplant procedure and follicular extraction look the same. I think in practice, it's much easier to get a great result with follicular transplantation. And the reason is that if you're doing 2,500 grafts at one time, you have a bell-shaped curve of 1, 2, 3, and 4 hair grafts. So you can take those 1 hair grafts, you put them at the hairline, the 2 hair grafts behind that, the 3s and 4s in the center, and you can create these nice gradients of density. When you're doing smaller procedures that you have to do an extraction, you have two problems. First of all, you're doing the procedure in stages, so it's much harder to design the transplant as a whole. But the other thing is that, and this is another problem that people don't talk about, is that when you're doing follicular extraction, you're extracting the larger follicular units. I mean, you imagine you're in the back of the scalp with a round punch. Which groups do you go for? Do you go for the 3-hair groups or do you go for the 1s? Well, you're going to try to minimize the amount of holes that you have.
Right.
So what happens is you get out the larger groups, but then you don't have enough small grafts for the hairline. So you end up dividing those bigger groups up. Hmm. So not only do you have the problems of extraction, but then you have to use microscopic dissection on those extracted units to get enough one single hair grafts for the hairline. And then on top of that, you really don't have, in many instances, enough grafts to really complete the whole transplant. So then you have to go back at another time, and you have the problem, obviously, of multiple sessions. If you do a second procedure after the grafts have fallen out, but before the new ones have thrown in, you lose your markings for the
right,
procedure.
Right.
So there are a lot of technical problems that, even though they're surmountable, I think when you put them all together, it's really much easier to get a real nice natural design using a strip where you have a large number of grafts to be at your disposal in one session.
Has there been any progress made in terms of the technology to minimize the scar, appearance of the scar on the back from strip excision?
There's been huge advances. And that's one of the things that's really encouraging, is that over time the strips get, you know, more efficient to remove, and the line scar becomes less and less. And one of the problems is that, you know, for many years people did, you know, plugs and bad procedures. Well, they also did bad donor scars. And I think people, you know, understand that the plugs have gotten smaller and they've eventually turned into follicular units, so it looks natural in the front. But they forget that we've also made advances in the back, too. And some of the real major advances are, one is that using staples instead of sutures. Mm-hmm. Sutures, although you have very good control over the wound edges, sutures cause some inflammation in the scalp, where staples are made out of stainless steel and they're inert, mm-hmm. so that they don't have any tissue reactivity, and therefore there's no hair that's lost from the staples, and that's very important. There's another advance called the trichophytic closure, where the upper edge of the incision, sometimes the lower edge, is trimmed away to actually allow the hair to go through the incision line and make the incision much less visible.
Oh, interesting. Is that a relatively new technique within the last year or something like that?
Yeah, within the last couple of years, Dr. Marzola in Australia had started working with it, and it's something that we use routinely in most of our patients now.
Is it more difficult to perform?
No, it's actually quite simple. Okay. It's not really clear the advantage it has in staples, although it seems to be as useful in staples to some degree as it is in sutures.
Mm-hmm.
It's particularly useful where people have had procedures already and you're making an incision through scar tissue. So you can actually trim away the edge of the scar tissue and make the closure much tighter.
Wow. So people that go for multiple sessions can effectively look like they've maybe only had one.
Right, okay. Right, only like one. Right. So there have been really advances. I think as many advances in the donor area as there have been in the front. So that's, you know, it's really encouraging. And then again, if there's ever a problem where there's a line scar, someone all of a sudden wants to keep their hair very short what they had in the past, we can take hair from around the scar and just put it into the scar.
Right.
That really decreases the visibility very significantly.
What are your thoughts on hair cloning? Is it going to be available anytime soon?
You know, I've been criticized for my conservative view about cloning, I think it's still about 5 to 10 years, probably closer to 10 years. And I've been actually saying this for 10 years now, 10 years, and people are always, you know, saying, "Oh, I'm too conservative." But so far, it's been borne true. It's a kind of a moving target. There are some very, very real steps that still have to be overcome before a cloning comes to fruition. And the major one is the fact that as you culture cells, they lose their ability to produce hair. They, what we call, de-differentiate.
Mm-hmm.
So that obstacle has not been overcome. And then, so technically we're not able to do cloning yet. Then we have to have the clinical trials, FDA approval, et cetera. So it's still, quite a ways off.
Right.
So even though, I'm a little bit cautious on proclaiming the next few years for cloning to be around. I think it is absolutely inevitable that cloning will be with us.
Really? Okay.
So I'm very, very encouraged and excited about it, although I think it's still...
Yeah, it's definitely very exciting.
Yeah. It'll be great. I think that, one of the things, though, that I tell people is that until we really have the technology in hand, I think it behooves us as physicians to really plan the surgery as if cloning is not available.
Right.
I think you can't do a transplant aggressively to hope that you'll be saved in the end by cloning. I think we have to plan all transplants at this point, both with, assuming that the cloning is not at hand and also assuming that medications are not going to work.
Right.
I think too many people do hair transplants based upon the hope that Propecia is going to continually hold on to their hair. And I think, all hair transplants should be really standalone procedures with existing technology.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, because you can't predict it, I guess, how long. You know, you may be able to push it back many years, but eventually, you may still lose the hair even from the medication, right?
Right.
Okay. So, in the case of hair loss that follows standard Norwood-Hamilton scale of pattern baldness, where you have a receding hairline and a bald spot forming at the crown. I mean, we know that transplants can, in many cases, be a good option. But what about cases where you are following the Ludwig scale of female pattern hair loss or baldness, where the hair loss is generally more spread out? Are transplants effective in this scenario where you have this diffuse pattern?
Right. Well, that's a really excellent question. Hair transplantation in women is actually very, very different from men. And, in men, most of the hair loss, as we mentioned, is pattern. We have a permanent donor zone in the back and sides. So essentially what you're doing is you're redistributing hair. You're not giving people more hair in a transplant, you're just moving it. For most women that lose their hair is actually distributed nicely. They have, as you mentioned, diffuse hair loss. So they still have a persistent hairline. When they groom the hair, they comb it certain ways, they can essentially look like they have a full head of hair. And since a hair transplant is an illusion to begin with, based on moving hair around with surgery, if you can move it with grooming, you really shouldn't do surgery.
Right.
So for the majority of women, changing their grooming patterns is really the best thing to do, at least initially.